Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to Adventures in Security, episode 15 for February 26, 2006. With your hosts, Tom Olzak, Larry Hines, and Chris Osborne. Yes, Chris is finally here. This is a weekly podcast published each Sunday evening sometime before midnight. You can find the information covered in our episodes at adventuresinsecurity.com/blog. If you're interested in commenting on what you hear or about topics you'd like us to talk about, please send email to podcasts@adventuresinsecurity.com. And here's Chris.
Thank you very much, the voice of Adventures in Security.
Oh, stop.
He had to do that.
Maybe you should go away, and we'll just make excuses for you again. Well, you're sleeping on the sleeping bag in the street tonight.
I did feel a little ill this morning, so... But I am a gushing father here now, so I must talk about my son and his wrestling. He was a champ today.
WWF?
Not WWF. Very club backyard wrestling. He broke the
That's even better.
Light bulb across some kid's face and smashed the chair against his head, and he was a champ. Now, this is real wrestling. He wrestles for a local...
Okay, wait. Okay. Yeah. For those of you who take exception with the fact that Chris just said that the WWF wasn't real wrestling. That's Chris Osborne, Chris.Osborne at ArudioSecurity.com.
Yeah, Randy Savage will be sending me an email here real soon, huh? Or showing up at my house. But he won today, two matches that he wrestled and pinned both kids and ended up being champ of his division. So first time that he's ever done that.
Oh, cool. Congrats.
First time he's done a sweep, first time he's won a medal, so... Actually, he's got a trophy at home, but that was a different tournament. So, but
that was for the Nerf Rocket tournament.
No, that was for the Pinewood Derby.
I see.
His dad.
I see. That was. I see that. So you have a trophy at home.
Let's not get into the details.
Okay.
In case the Scoutmaster listens to this.
He painted the car. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I haven't polled all three listeners of this podcast, but I don't believe your Scoutmaster is one of them.
We'll just keep that our little secret here. So, and the rest of the world, whoever listens to our podcast, by the way, Chris Osborne is your moderator. Tom, as you know, is the voice, and we also know Larry. He's going to take the let's just say technical end of whatever discussions we have. So we're trying to organize our podcast a little more and do what, Tom? What, one, two topics? One with a little more technical and another with more of a management flair to it?
Yeah, the original purpose of Arudio Security, which is a company that Chris and I started, was to teach security to business managers. But we want to expand the podcast a little farther than that, and we want to make sure that we're handling topics that are interesting or of interest to anybody who's responsible for information security. So what we're going to do on each podcast is we're going to discuss one topic that is primarily technical, and then we'll go into another topic that would be of interest mostly to managers. And we'll probably end up doing the technical one first, because if you're like Larry, his attention span is about 5 minutes. So we wouldn't expect him to stick around for the management piece.
Sweet. Thanks, Tom.
We'll keep him on track here. He's playing with Wonder Woman right now.
It's a good luck charm.
Got his little statue. Yeah, his good luck charm.
It's interesting that he sits down, opens up his laptop, and hangs a Wonder Woman keychain onto the lid. It makes me wonder why I hired him, but, you know.
I think that's why you hired me.
Okay. Do we have something to talk?
Yeah, I think we do, guys. Let's hit the first one, which is the one with the technical flair. Our topic for that is sorting through the security in the cloud debate. So there's been a lot of talk these days about security in the cloud. Security in the cloud is generally defined as protection provided by internet service providers, or ISPs. That results in only clean packets arriving at the subscriber's perimeter. Positions on the topic range from it's a bad idea, to give everything over to the managed service provider. Now, based on our experience as a group dealing with security, we have sort of a middle-of-the-road approach or position. In this episode, we're going to explore both sides of the managed service debate. We'll also explain why we believe the most effective solution lies somewhere between the two extremes. Discuss this debate, our esteemed sidekick professional here, Larry Hines.
Sidekick. Thanks, Chris. Discussing the security in the cloud stuff, it's not something I'm really good at because, I mean, it's Cumulus, positive and negative, electrons. Cirrus clouds, things like that.
Larry.
What?
Larry. Not that cloud.
Larry. Oh, I'm sorry. No,
lightning
actually.
And thunder?
Yeah.
It's a clear day here.
It is. The security in the cloud debate, you know, where your ISP would be providing a lot of the services that you would normally do in-house, such as, spam and email filtering, malicious traffic filtering, all the things that you would normally do in-house, gets pushed beyond your perimeter and out to your ISP or data provider. That's one position to take, and quite honestly, and Tom might be able to speak to this as well, that I'm not even sure those services fully exist at the moment. Tom, what do you think?
Well, yeah, those services exist, but the issue, not necessarily to the extent that a lot of people want them to exist,
mm-hmm.
which is make sure that the service providers and the telcos are responsible for making sure that all packets that arrive at a business or a home perimeter are clean. And, you know, the courts have held that ISPs today are not responsible for that. And as we go through this discussion today, I think one of the things that we're going to take a look at is, should they be?
I agree, Tom. You don't want your vendor responsible for all of your data security. Which brings us to the second position, or second way to look at this, is that, you know, it's a bad idea and that you want to do some of this stuff in-house. But, you know, let's explain the technology a little bit. The way it's going to work is that if, depending on your business and the type of services you're offering, if you have a website, there's anti-phishing and anti-cracker protection against that. The ISP would take care of that and have some filtering upstream beyond your perimeter, in front of your web servers. Same thing with anti-malware viruses. They would filter that traffic on the way in before it gets to you. Conversely, if you didn't have that service, if you look at your external firewall, you're going to see all kinds of scanning and malware hitting that interface. What this is doing is the ISP is going to take care of that traffic and those nasties upstream beyond you. Well, that's how it works. Now, you can plug in any service or any protection you want upstream at the ISP, but basically, they're going to handle all that stuff before it even gets to your firewall, gets to any of your servers.
Okay, so let's talk about that for a minute. What you're saying is that the ISP acts as this barrier, or a series of barriers that incrementally remove bad things from the data stream coming in from the internet before it gets to the business perimeter. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct.
From what I've been seeing is there's a lot of people who say that the ISPs should be fully responsible for making sure that that stuff doesn't get to the perimeter. My question is, if the ISPs lock it down that tight, what mechanisms in place to make sure that they don't stop good data that their technology thinks is bad?
And that's a great point, and that's one of the major barriers to a service like this is you know, with dealing with telcos in general, it's a slow process. So if they're blocking good traffic, then you're going to have to go through the normal process to get that stuff fixed, where the same challenge you have internally, if you have an internal IPS or one of these systems that might block good traffic. But the plus being that if it's internal, you manage it and you can tweak those rules and get the traffic flowing again, where if it's on the outside, you know, it could be hours or days or even at all if they're not willing to change their policies.
Yeah, but bringing it in-house creates another problem, and that is resources. I mean, if you try to go through all the information that gets collected and look at all the reports from all the different pieces, you have to have a pretty decent-sized security team. Most small and medium-sized businesses don't have that kind of a security budget. And even large companies, that's really not a core competency. So, you know, if you leave it outside, there's some downside to that. If you bring it inside, there's a downside to that. So what would happen if we used both sides? If we used the security in the cloud as just a layer of protection before it got to the protection that exists within the business?
That's a great way to do it. That's the way we are currently doing it, and we've architected a system to do just that, where we leverage the good stuff on both of them. Some of the security services from a third party or an ISP type place, and then some of the stuff that we really wanted to bring in house, we did.
Yeah. So and the decision making point was, what are the things that we don't add a lot of value to by doing it in house? One of those things is going through all the intrusion detection logs, trying to figure out what's going on in our network. And we have the managed service security service provider that we selected can do that much better than we can, bring more resources to bear as necessary, and can do it 24/7, whereas we're really not in a position to do that.
I was going to say that.
Okay, yeah, you should have said it, but you didn't. I did, so stop it. So just be quiet.
It's been done. It's covered.
So security in the cloud, in my opinion, is something that is just another layer in a defense in depth posture. It's the ISP cannot be held totally responsible. The telcos can't be held totally responsible for cleaning up all the packets before they get to a business. Now, having said that, I believe that they have some responsibility. They're providing a service. They're responsible for the infrastructure, not just the national infrastructure, but the international infrastructure over which the internet is run. And they have some responsibility to help to protect the users of that infrastructure. What I'm having a problem with is the movement by ISPs and by the carriers to put these in place or put protection in place as a pay service. In other words, if you want us to help protect you from the bad data that's going over our infrastructure, then we're going to charge you a fee. And I have a problem with that. Comments?
You know, I read up about all the new push by telcos to have a tiered internet approach. And something like this is a perfect stepping stone to get that in place. If they're filtering traffic and everything right, you know, for businesses right off the get-go, they have quality of service in place already that's turned on, that they could easily say, well, you go to Google a lot, and if you want Google to come up quicker or as fast as it used to, we're going to charge you 50 cents a meg or something berserk like that. So, yeah, I agree with you, Tom. There's potential for abuse.
And that was kind of my question, too, was the legality matters here. How accountable is an ISP, and you're paying for this service? They can just send you whatever they feel like, just like an open, non-filtered connection? Is that basically how they...
Yeah, I think when you're paying for like a data line, like a T1 or something, that generally it's unfiltered. There's steps they take. They want their network to be clean, so I think they're on their end trying to remove bad traffic, but they're not going any length to make sure that the stuff hitting your firewall is any cleaner than
if something bad made it through. They're not responsible at all.
Yeah, I mean, we've all had friends or relatives call up and say, I think one of the RPC worms didn't even need an email, just hit your computer connected to your broadband, and I had lots of people call me, so they obviously weren't filtering that out, even though it was known. So.
Well, they're not responsible for it.
No.
The courts have held that they are not responsible.
But you're still paying a fee for that.
Well, no, not for protection.
No, that's the direction they're headed.
But really, I mean, this is probably a service that a small company, like you said earlier, would employ. They're going to go to the ISP and say, hey, we can't do this ourselves.
Yeah,
so it's going to be based more on that than it is, hey, this is the best way to do it.
Yeah, but it's more... For their internal stuff, yes, I'm fully in agreement with that. They should pay for that if they have a managed service provider provide that. But there's a level of protection that should be provided by the carriers and the ISPs as data passes through their infrastructure. They should have a fiduciary responsibility to ensure that the services they are providing are not going to harm the information assets of their customers or their subscribers.
And that would be a normal course of business. If I signed up with an ISP, you say that you think that that's what they should provide, and I shouldn't have to pay any extra to have this filtering done.
Well, I'm talking about not doing filtering specifically for you. I'm talking about general filtering. It goes back to the fact that we don't have a national response to a worm or some other threat that gets thrown onto the internet. There's no concerted effort by carriers, by service providers, to help to block that.
I see.
And part of that responsibility, in my opinion, resides with the federal government. And the federal government has done almost nothing to bring the different organizations together, pool resources, and protect the national infrastructure.
Well, not even Homeland Security?
Well, the thing, too, is that there's probably plenty of people who don't want that to happen. I mean, if you're an AV software company, and,
sure,
and there's going to be infrastructure in place to help with those things, then, you know, people are going to be as likely to buy your stuff, I suppose.
Good to let it go.
Yeah.
In their interest, sure.
Well, but it's also in the interest of... I don't disagree with that, and that may be a big part of it, but at some point, we've got to be able to protect our national infrastructure, our business infrastructure, from cyber terrorism.
Yeah.
Cyber terrorism is a real threat today. Cyber espionage, and not just between governments, but cyber espionage against business is a big threat today. And the internet is like the Wild West used to be. Everything's wide open, and it's everybody for himself. And the carriers and the providers aren't stepping up. Now, I'm painting this and saying and making a very general statement. There are some providers that do provide some level of protection. But in many cases, they don't. The telephone carriers, they don't work together. Nobody works together at a central location or from a central coordination point to react to big threats like the Kama Sutra worm that get released on the internet. So I truly believe that businesses should pay for the standard filtering and protection that should go on within their own perimeter. But I don't believe that any of us should have to pay for just basic protection up in the cloud. And there's one other issue. The proponents of security in the cloud have a tendency to believe that if you block everything before it gets to the perimeter, then the subscriber is going to be just fine. Well, what happens if a traveling user comes in with the laptop that's been infected with a worm out at the hotel and they jack it in a conference room Ethernet port and they release a worm onto the network? If you don't have internal protection that's at least as good as what you might find in the cloud, your entire network's going to get infected, and it doesn't really matter what the telco or what the ISP is doing. So the responsibility of a business to protect its information assets can't be thrown over the wall to somebody else. They can't point the finger and say, you should be protecting me. I shouldn't have to put any protection on my network. That just can't happen.
Okay, fantastic. So that was our debate of security in the cloud. And I think we covered quite a few good topics from a management and technical perspective there. So now we're going to get into the more of the business management topic for the episode today, which is security critical success factors. Within the context of information security, critical success factors are objectives or goals that must be met before an organization can provide reasonable and appropriate protection for its information assets. We'll explore 7 CSFs, or critical success factors, that lead to an acceptable level of information asset assurance. And with that, I will turn it over to the voice of Adventures in Security, that is Tom Olczak.
You know, this whole voice thing, just because I want to read the opening for the show, don't make me hurt you.
But it's silky smooth, man.
Yeah.
Your voice, Isaac Hayes. Your voice hurts me.
Yeah. Thank you. Anyway, we're going to go over 7 critical success factors. These are sort of taken from ISO 17799, but these are my take on that. And we're going to go through these and have a discussion about each one. If you want more detailed information on these topics, you can go to our blog at adventuresinsecurity/blog, or you can wait till April when my book will be coming out called Just Enough Security.
Wow, imagine that.
Stop it. All right. The first CSF is management support. The support of all levels of management is necessary, and it's the foundation for an effective security program. But to optimize this critical success factor, the support has to begin at the top floor with the chief executive officer, and it has to be pushed down to all subsequent management layers. All of us have worked in organizations where security was not an important day-to-day activity.
Absolutely.
The CEO was not interested in it. In fact, until Sarbanes-Oxley and HIPAA, there were most companies relegated security to just account management.
Yeah. And some companies today that aren't affected by those, they don't even seem to be concerned with security in the least.
Those fines usually motivate people pretty quickly.
Well, and it's not just the fines. People just didn't think about it,
right,
and they didn't realize what the consequences were. And with malicious hackers now starting to focus on making money as opposed to just being funny, oh, did that rhyme?
Yeah.
Then
honey.
People are starting to get more focused on protecting personal information. So the second critical success factor: security policies, standards, guidelines, and procedures designed to meet strategic and operational business objectives need to be documented, and the employees need to be trained in those areas. So first of all, let's take a look at what a policy should contain. It should contain a description of a program element or operational system. So an example of a system-level policy would be a policy that pertains to maybe your financial systems. A program policy is a little bit higher up. It'll make a very general statement about some aspect of your security program in general. The next thing that a policy should contain would be the objectives to be met through adherence to the policy. Now, these objectives shouldn't just be made up. They should be in line with the strategy and objectives of the business overall. The next component of a policy are high-level statements of administrative, physical, or technical guidance for reaching the policy's objectives. The next thing is a statement of responsibility for administration, application, and enforcement of the policy. And finally, the possible sanctions for failing to follow the policy. And it's this last piece that is often left out of policies. More organizations are very hesitant to actually put in writing what will happen to you if you don't follow a policy. But without employees understanding the consequences of not adhering to standards and guidelines, they're not going to have a lot of teeth.
So, Tom, this is what you would call a whacking, correct?
Yes. The sanctions
Excellent.
Are the whacking section. That is correct. So let's talk a little bit about what standards and guidelines are. Standards are mandatory configurations or activities, the performance of which supports one or more policy objectives. So standards are things you have to do. Guidelines differ from standards in one characteristic. They aren't mandatory. Managers can use guidelines to make decisions about security issues when no specific standard exists. And finally, a procedure is a step-by-step plan for producing an outcome. So it can be for building a server, putting in a router, deploying an application, etc.
Now, might I add a little plug here for Arudio Security? I believe this is part of what Arudio Security stands for and what we do. Security policies, evaluations, gaps, analysis, anything else that you might want to add to that? Tom?
No, nice commercial spot there.
Sorry. Had to do that.
Yeah.
So anybody interested in that, if you have a security policy you want to have.
For those of you who have a problem with podcasters tooting their own horn, that again, that's chris.osborne@arudiosecurity.com.
He likes bold caps when you email him.
Okay. So the next critical success factor is assurance that can be reached only through risk management. And unless an organization has an unlimited security budget, and I know we certainly don't, resource constraints prevent a security manager from reducing overall risk to zero. Instead, she must decide how to apply her security dollars to achieve the greatest impact. This is accomplished through the use of risk management. Well-defined risk management processes can provide her with a clear picture of the threats and vulnerabilities related to each critical business system. Armed with this information, she can target specific activities to reduce risk to levels acceptable to senior management. One of the things that Larry's been working on over the last couple of months is a threat modeling process for the company that we work for. And the threat modeling process it really goes to risk management. It starts with the creation of a picture of what the system or the environment looks like that you're going to assess. It then goes to an assessment of the types of threats that might be thrown against that environment, and then it ends what's called an attack tree, or what Microsoft calls a threat tree, so that you can trace through all the different things that need to happen before a vulnerability can be exploited. And the reason this is important is that when someone audits an organization and throws in front of the security team, or throws in front of the IS manager, or throws in front of executive management a vulnerability they found, and they got this out of COBIT, they got this out of ISO, out of the ISO standard, or wherever they got it from, they usually throw it on the table in isolation. What threat modeling allows you to do is to go in and determine just how much risk this particular vulnerability presents to your network. And it puts it within the context of all of the other safeguards that you have in place, and allows you to decide whether or not this is even something that you want to worry about. Vulnerabilities that might seem like extremely critical within your own environment, because again, the other safeguards you have in place, may be very low risk, while a vulnerability that on the surface looks minor might in your environment be a high risk vulnerability. So risk management is very important to making sure that you apply your risk dollars appropriately to reduce overall risk to your information assets. The next critical success factor is making sure you have an active security awareness program. As indicated earlier when we were talking about policies, policies are great, but if your employees don't know about them, then there's no way that those are going to have any impact on the security of your network. An effective security awareness program goes beyond posting policies, standards, guidelines, and procedures to the company intranet. Maximum impact is achieved through frequent, formal communication in which employees are educated on what security means to the business and to them. One of the things, there are really three layers of training for awareness. The first layer is just the general training, and that's for the general employee population. The next one is technical training, and technical training is normally done for the IS department. There are things that they need to know about that the general population does not need to know. And the other layer of training is management. Managers' training not only should include the training for the general employee population, but it should also include the company's statement of responsibility, what that means to managers, how managers need to incorporate security into every single operational task they perform every day. The next thing is an adequate security budget. So we've talked about all these great things, policies, security program, etc., but without an adequate security budget, the first four CSFs are useless. A successful security budget should, at a minimum, include dollars for infrastructure, penetration and vulnerability tests, day-to-day tasks performed by a dedicated security team. Now, dedicated security teams, small and medium-sized businesses can't really afford that, but that's where the managed service providers, managed security service providers come in. So in our previous conversation about security in the cloud, there are some situations, as Chris brought up, where it is necessary to pay somebody to come in and provide the necessary security for your network.
I've actually worked at a place where they were in between. They weren't bound by Sarbanes-Oxley, and obviously they were not in healthcare, so they didn't have the HIPAA requirements. And there was absolutely zero security budget, and so you ended up doing everything with free tools, and you had to incorporate the security stuff into your normal engineering day, and then they would wonder why when we would get hit with something really awful that there wasn't something in place. It's not nearly impossible. It's impossible to have a good security program with no budget and no visibility from management. That's for sure.
And the way that you get a budget is to make the case through risk management, through showing return on security investment. It's a business process. It's, you know, most security managers are a lot, not most, but a lot of security managers came up for the technical ranks. I know I did. And they lose sight of the fact that when asking for security dollars, you're just like everybody else. You're going for that pool of capital dollars, pool of expense dollars, and you have to make the appropriate business case. And it's not easy, because when security is successful, there's no outward expression of that. There's no outward evidence of it, except that, okay, this year we didn't get whacked by a worm. So it's not an easy job, but it's something that needs to be put into terms that corporate executives understand. The next critical success factor is a documented incident management program supported by a trained incident response team. One of the three basic areas of concern for security managers is availability. A well-designed incident management program executed by a regularly trained IRT, or incident response team, ensures a rapid recovery from security incidents with a minimal impact on the business. And that's really the primary objective of a good incident management program, and that is to recover quickly from incidents so that you minimize impact on the business. And it's an iterative process. At the end of each service recovery, you sit down, you have a discussion, figure out what happened, what should have happened, how can we get better, how can we shorten the time to recovery so that we can mitigate impact. And the final one is the use of simple, meaningful metrics. It's important to measure the success of the first six CSFs. Metrics provide the tool necessary to accomplish this, but a manager must make sure metrics management doesn't become a career path in his organization. Instead, metrics should measure the outcomes of critical security systems and processes. Once collected and analyzed, the results show senior management the business value realized from security spending. One of the tools you can use to ensure that your security budget is sufficient is to use metrics. One metric that many security managers like to use is one that I brought up earlier, and that is for 3 years we were whacked by a worm every year, and for the last 2 years we haven't been, and that's because we did X. So it's important to make sure that you toot your own horn, that you make sure that the people who sign the checks understand what has not happened because they spent some money.
And that's tough. I mean, that with most things you can get, your return on investment is something you can kind of measure. In security, you have to come up with, all the things you've prevented, which is hard to make some people see that, we haven't gotten hit with this, or we haven't had any disclosure and information. So it's a challenge for sure.
This is just a basic list of success factors. The list might grow, shrink, or consist of a much different set of CSFs. The important thing is the process through which a manager arrives at the end result. The journey required to build a meaningful list of CSFs has some side effects, including a better understanding of the strengths, vulnerabilities, and threats related to your network and to individual systems. The topics in this episode are covered in more detail in Tom's upcoming book, Just Enough Security, which is scheduled, and I say scheduled, for publication in April of this year.
It's at the editor.
Plug, plug.
So with that, we would like to wrap up this episode, and thank you all for joining us today.
I got to be with Don Knotts.
And actually, we would like to maybe even dedicate this episode to our favorite comedian of all time, the nervous professor or presenter, Don Knotts. I believe he was, what, 81?
81.
Or so, something like that. And we, some of us grew up, I think, watching him or watching reruns.
Fife in the Sky, yeah.
But, anyway, so that is it for this episode. And remember, be careful what you click.